Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Judy Wiseman, globally renowned professor at the London School of Economics and best-selling author. Judy, you have this incredible background. You've done so much. You're a giant in your field. So thank you for coming in today and sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
It's a pleasure. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, you know, Judy, you've done so much. You've had so much success in your life. Perhaps you can tell us, you know, what led to you receiving your Career Achievement Award from the American Sociological Association?
Well, I got the award from the Information and Communications Studies section of the American Sociological Association. And I've been working on what's known as science and technology studies, or the sociology of technology, for, you know, well on 30 years now. And I mean, as you know, communication scholars, technology scholars, new media scholars, lots of people have been thinking about technology now for a very long time. And I actually came in at the time of what was known as the microelectronic revolution, if you could think back that far, when chips were new. And I've been part of contributing to what's now a flourishing field in social science, looking sort of deeply and in detail on the impact of technology on every aspect of our private lives, on work, how we communicate, how we live. And so the award was really for, in recognition of that work, that accumulation of work over a long period of time.
You know, that's kind of fascinating, this idea of the social impact, maybe the cultural and other impacts of technology and the different participants in it. So that's an amazing body of work, and you know, you're a pioneer in the field. Now, there's this idea that you put out, techno-feminism. Can you talk about that? What is the essence of it?
Well, what I was trying to get across there, I mean, and it's part of a more general argument about the social relations of technology, that when we think about technologies, we too often think about technologies as somehow neutral, and that we just get the technologies that are the best technologies. And one of the main themes generally in the field has been how much the technologies we have actually reflect society. That really I think about technologies as crystallizations of society. And so I make the argument that if we've got a society that's characterized by hierarchical gender relations, race relations, various kinds of inequalities, that these will be reflected in the kinds of technologies we get. And so one of the themes of my books on gender and technology is to really talk about the history of the connection between masculinity and technology, that somehow even the way we think about what technology is in terms of industrial technologies and cars and machines and computers has historically been constructed as a sphere in which men operate, and in a way as spheres that are incompatible with femininity. And so the point of my books on gender and technology has just been to say, well, let's examine, you know, where did this relationship between gender and technology get established, and how can we reframe this so that women participate equally in the digital revolution?
Well, that's a really fascinating area. I know when I've talked to Maria Clave on this topic, she's sort of quite passionate about it as well. So can you talk about the tension then with women and men in corporate management?
Well, I think that, you know, the tension is sort of twofold. I mean, one is a well-recognized, you know, practical problem. And I mean, it's so cliche to say it, but actually the division of labor, of childcare, you know, the notions of motherhood and fatherhood, although they've changed radically, and although fathers are now participating much more in parenting than they were in the 60s, I mean, it's a phenomenal transformation. It's still the case that ultimately somehow responsibility for children and guilt about parenting rests much more with women than men. And so when I've done studies of men and women in corporate management, what I still find is that many more men have full-time partners who look after kids and take the burden, if you like, I don't mean in a negative way, off of them. And so that inequality and the sort of prejudice that women aren't as reliable as men in terms of workers is still to do with childcare. But I think the other thing that's well worth mentioning is that even when women do perform in exactly the way that men do, whether they've got children or they haven't, there's still, I think, an element of leadership style in which sort of being driven, being cool, being available 24/7, being ambitious, that a lot of the characteristics of leadership, I think, are ones that women find very hard to be seen as being convincing at. I'm not saying that women can't do it, and of course they can do it, but I think there's a perception that when women are doing it, they don't have quite the same authority as men, and so it's harder for women to fulfill the senior leadership roles, that men somehow are seen as more acceptable in those roles. And I think that issue of sort of style, of leadership style, is one we haven't fully overcome.
You know, it's just really interesting. I can see the difficulties, you know, the new PM of Australia and sort of the tension and the attacks sometimes that she's receiving. So and maybe this gets into this idea of moral license, you know, where, you know, maybe...
Well, I think that's right, and I think it's very interesting that the new... you know, Prime Minister of Britain, Theresa May, you know, has, you know, they say that she had been described by some of her colleagues as a very difficult woman. And you just sort of think, well, actually, what is this description of a very difficult woman? She's incredibly competent, hardworking, all of those things. But you sort of never quite get the same tag of a very difficult man as you do with a woman. I think there is still a problem about women in those very senior roles.
So what about feminism confronting technology? What are your thoughts in that area?
Well, that's an older book than Technofeminism, and so it was much more historical, if you like. It was before the current digital revolution, and it was more concerned with the history of engineering and what we take engineering to be. And, you know, one of the things I talked about in that book, which still seems to me the case, is that, you know, our notion of men and engineering and technology is actually quite a 19th century notion. It's quite a modern notion. And I go back to looking at how arts and crafts and weaving and lots of things that women did historically used to be considered as of equal status, actually, with male technologies. And that, you know, we've only historically recently had this modern definition of what technology is and separated it off from arts and crafts, the sort of things women do. And I mean, one of the ways I illustrate this with my students, Stephen, is that I talk about the fact that in London, on one side of the street, there's a science museum, and on the other side of the street, there's a very famous Victorian Albert Museum. And in the Victorian Albert Museum, we have got pottery and arts and crafts and furniture and weaving and those sort of things. And then you go across the road and in the Science Museum and you're confronted by locomotives and space technologies. And still it's the case that many more women visit the Victorian Albert Museum than visit the Science Museum. And, you know, you still have this old historical divide between what's seen as proper technology, you know, heavy machines, and what's seen as a more feminine sphere of skills.
So do you see this changing as time goes on, and for what reason?
I think there's been a huge change, because when I started working on mobile technologies and digital technologies, it was the case that there was a very sharp digital divide, because, of course, the first people to get computers were hobbyists, the first people to get mobile phones were men. In the early days, there was a very, very big divide. I mean, that divide has almost disappeared now. And if you look at things like social media, you find that young women are actually on social media even more than men, that the ownership of smartphones is equally distributed. So I think in terms of the consumption of technologies, if I can put it that way, in the use of technologies, in the ownership of technologies, the gender divide has disappeared. Where it hasn't disappeared is in issues to do with the design of technologies. You know, who's in Silicon Valley, who's in engineering schools, who is in London designing games, video games. I mean, those sort of design issues, the innovation streams, are still heavily masculinized, and I'm very concerned about that inequality and the effect it has on what sort of games or technologies get designed, because I'm a strong believer in the fact that people can only design things in a sense based on their own experience, and that you get technologies that reflect designers' own values and preferences.
So do you see some kind of programs or solutions to rectify this in some way?
Well, I think there's much more awareness in engineering schools, in Silicon Valley, in corporations, of the need to include more women, to have more diverse managers, more diverse engineers, because unless you have diversity in the design and innovation stage, you'll actually miss out on lots of markets, on lots of users, because the sort of technology that you design actually won't be suitable for lots of consumers. So I think there is a big change, and there's lots of discussion about these issues in a way there wasn't even 10 years ago.
So what are then the factors in the social shaping of technology?
Ah, well, there I very much talk about the fact that, I mean, what I'm trying to stress there is that technology, it is true that technology is very much, if you like, constrained by previous technologies. And there are particular, of course, physical and material affordances that limit the sort of technologies we have. But I also think that the political, economic, and social context have a huge role to play. And so I think it's very important to recognize that if you think about the internet and computing, you need to understand that a lot of the technologies we have were actually originally financed by huge investment in military technologies. And that was the case in the US, in Europe, in Britain, that a lot of the impetus for technologies was actually the state through the military. And so, you know, a question I think we need to ask, and I mean, if you think about pizzas being delivered by drones, for example, which is a contemporary thing, or self-driving cars, I think it's worth thinking back and looking at, well, you know, where did the idea of drones come from? Was it initially something that the military thought up? Would it be the case that if we spent a lot of research and development on technologies that weren't initially military, might we get a different set of options, different kinds of technological imaginaries, if you like, different kinds of technological ideas that might emerge, rather than so often thinking about commercial applications of what were initially military technologies?
Not just fascinating. Now, you know, you have this book that came out, I guess, last year. Can you share some of the takeaways from it?
Ah, that book is about Press for Time. And I'm trying there to get at the relationship between technology and time. And this, you know, common perception, this taken for granted perception today, that we're all rushed and pressed for time, that we're busy, busy, busy. I mean, I just saw an ad actually for the new Samsung Galaxy, and it was literally called Busy, Busy, Busy. And it's full of images of people trying to multitask and do lots of things at once. And the smartphone is posited as being the solution to this problem. You know, if only we had the right technology, we'd manage to do a million things at once and we wouldn't have this problem of being so pressed for time. And what I try and argue in the book is that, in fact, the reason we're so pressed for time is actually not simply to do with technologies, but because of the priorities and parameters we set ourselves, that we actually live in a culture where being busy is valued. You know, to say you're very busy is to say you're a valuable member of society, that your time is terribly precious, and that we all want to present ourselves as being busy all the time. So I think we need to sort of deconstruct the cultural status and value that comes with busyness and not see ourselves as victims of technology. So that's sort of one of the main things I try and talk about. And that feeds into the second issue, which is this idea that somehow technology is the problem and the solution. You know, that technology is the problem, it's constant connectivity, it's endless interruptions, and the solution is better and better technologies. And I'm trying to say that that's a too simplistic way of constructing the issue, and that we really sort of need to think about what we want to get done, how we think about time, how we value what we do with time, and then think about, well, what technologies will be most appropriate to that. And the third theme of the book is very much to say that actually speed is much more a resource of the powerful than it is of the powerless, that actually some of us are enabled to go very fast because other people are slow. And if you just think about things like, I mean, we're both in airports, Stephen, you and I, a lot. There are fast queues and there are slow queues, and the more people are in the fast queues, the longer people will be waiting in the slow queues. And that's the same with lots of aspects of society now, that those of us who are privileged are enabled to go fast, to get taxis, to do all sorts of things that save us time, to not have to do our own housework. And there are all these other people who spend a lot of time doing labour and waiting in order to enable the speed of others. So it's trying to, I guess, articulate a dialectical relationship between speed and slowness.
That's some interesting concepts, and especially this idea of privilege. And privilege gives you sort of access, and access gives you the ability to be fast and to have impact. And maybe there's epigenetic effects from this, where it's generational and it's going to be passed on. And do you ever think about that at all? People who have sort of generationally been locked into not having these kinds of access, how do they get out of it if there are sort of epigenetic impacts of privilege?
Well, I mean, I very much as a sociologist am concerned with the increasing inequality in developed societies particularly and in the world generally. I mean, the inequalities, and whenever I pick up a paper, I just glance at a newspaper today and there was a piece on the incredible soaring salaries of chief executives of companies, and even Theresa May, our Prime Minister, saying it's all gone too far and we really need to have shareholders being more active in corporations to try and restrain runaway wages. I mean, we do now live in societies where the proportion of pay between workers and managers has gotten out of all proportion. And so I think we need to be very cognizant of the fact that there's few of us who are flying around the world all the time and are privileged to be living this very sort of mobile existence, and lots of other people whose circumstances are very bad, and that we do need, I mean, I could go on about this for ages, but we do need much more to have some state policies tackling the inequality that's increasing all the time.
You know, we are also in this sort of era of disruption. I'm just thinking of the fourth industrial revolution, or some call it second machine age, or Martin Ford, the rise of the robots. What are your views on the rapid emergence of robots on society?
I think that the talk is much more extensive than the reality. I mean, I have to say, going to engineering conferences is a very good antidote to this, because people will tell you honestly that the gap between the notion that robots are actually going to soon have emotions and, you know, human intelligence and be able to be carers, that these things are actually phenomenally exaggerated, and that people who are actually working on the ground with social robotics, I mean, this conference I was at in Adelaide last week, there was someone who runs a lab on interactive social robots who was saying to me, that actually the advances are so crude compared to the conversation about it. So I think that's one very important thing to say about it. But having said that, I think, you know, we've always been fascinated by robots, you know, from if you go back to Metropolis and all the sort of science fiction writers, you know, there is something, and you go back to classics, to Homer and, you know, classical Greek writing. I mean, right through human history, there are these worries about, you know, people creating machines that will have a life of their own. And it's a very sort of powerful image. And I think it's no accident that the roboticists of today keep designing robots that look like cute children or attractive women or cuddly pets. That I think that all of this mimicking of the human is because they know that we somehow have this amazing sort of innate ability to sort of anthropomorphize machines and to really think these robotic pets have got a life of their own, and to, as Sherry Turkle has said, that, you know, we worry about if we leave them that they'll be lonely and all of these sort of things. So, I mean, it's true that they have an incredible attraction to us, that we're incredibly seduced by these sort of robots. But actually, I think we need to be very careful in realizing that actually, you know, these machines don't have feelings. They're just projections. They're our projections rather than a reality.
You know, I guess McKinsey has this study indicating that if AI, natural language processing, reaches sort of average human levels, then 58% of jobs, at least in the U.S., could be automated. And there's this idea that maybe it's cheaper to have a factory of robots and fully automated rather than this idea of setting up factories in developing countries. And that used to be a path for developing countries to become wealthy, was manufacturing and cheap labor. But now automation is cheaper. And you have GE, they have this factory, multimodal factory, where it's, you know, they can operate at 1/10 the cost through automation, and it's many times more efficient. Are you worried about this the impact on labor markets and jobs and things like that?
I mean, I'm much more worried about it in developing countries than I am in you know, Western countries, I have to say. I mean, I do think that industrial labour, that manufacturing labour, you know, can be hugely automated. And of course, particularly in China, you know, I read like you do that there are going to be fully automated factories, and that a lot of the path of development, as you say, will be sort of cut off. But I have to say that most of the discussions I go to are anxieties in the West. And in that context, I think McKinsey and a lot of the reports that are coming out now are extraordinarily exaggerated, and I think a lot of them are made by economists and consultants who don't actually study the workplace. I mean, I have spent a lifetime studying work and employment, and actually it is very hard to automate lots of service sector jobs, for example. And what you see much more in a lot of workplaces is technology working with people, that the most efficient thing is actually, you know, people and technology working together rather than a simple substitution effect. So I'm not as worried about this because, I mean, let me give you an example. There's a lot of talk about accountants and lawyers and radiographers and doctors and lecturers and all of these things completely automated. I've been hearing these stories for a very long time. There are more lawyers than there were 30 years ago when I first read about the complete automation of lawyers. I think a much better discussion would be to talk about the fact that lots of professional work does entail routine repetitious work, that work is very easy to automate, but there's a lot of new kinds of work that we can't even anticipate yet that gets produced when we automate some other kinds of work. And so I think we need a much more nuanced discussion that actually looks at the kinds of work there is. For example, in teaching, you know, I've been told for years that we could just deliver our lectures digitally that students wouldn't want to come, you know, what would students want to come to courses for? But actually we know that at the most elite universities, what students pay for is personal contact, because education can't just be automated. So I'm sort of very skeptical about the extreme predictions, actually.
Well, that's interesting, and I guess somewhat contrary now to maybe sort of the trending thoughts, where, you know, when you see the news and media. But you would know, because you study this, right? So, okay, let's talk about AI itself. So what do you think of the consequences of the integration of AI, artificial intelligence, to every aspect of our lives? What do you think the social ramifications are going to be of that?
Well, I do have some thoughts about that. I mean, again, I think the picture, I mean, it's rather unpopular to be the skeptic, and I know I'm going against most trends, you know, and it isn't a way to sell books, I know that. But I mean, you know, I've been hearing about the Internet of Things for a very long time. I mean, again, I think in some ways it's exaggerated. But, I mean, what I do worry about in terms of that is the discussion about big data and algorithms as if these things aren't themselves social. And I'm sure you know the cases, Stephen, where whether it's Airbnb or the use of big data for deciding on policing, that there's lots of cases already, or job recruitment, where it's very clear that there's all kinds of discrimination creeping in, that actually algorithms, you know, that machine learning learns the prejudices that we already have. So that, for example, with recruitment, I just saw an example the other day which was about machine learning, saying, well, if the machine learning app was being used on a recruitment site, and if the first time it did this, it noticed that actually young people were getting preference over old people in recruitment sites, then actually the machine would quickly learn to shortlist only young people. But there are all kinds of ways. We know with the policing issue that there's been an issue of identifying black areas as being areas of high crime, and then reproducing that in the kinds of algorithms that one would use in terms of the distribution of policing. So I'm very worried about the notion that, you know, that somehow artificial intelligence is neutral, is a better judge than people. You know, I often hear, for example, I mean, this is, you know, speaking of judges, it's often said to me, well, you know, judges are tired after lunch. Wouldn't it be better for a machine to make decisions about, you know, how long somebody would have to go to prison or something? And I worry about those kinds of assumptions, actually, which is not to say that people aren't fallible, but I think it's a myth to think that machines are neutral and will make better judgments based on neutral facts and information.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the dangers, the biases that we have get inserted into all of this automation and intelligence, artificial intelligence that's around us.
Well, absolutely, that's putting it perfectly. And the problem is that it's much more disguised, that people can't see that, so that if you want to appeal or disagree, it's much easier if there's a person's prejudice than, you know, having to make an argument about how the machine was somehow prejudiced. That's a much more difficult argument.
Now we're going to switch directions a bit.
Yes,
here. Judy, you're in high demand as a keynote speaker. So from your travels, can you share some of the top questions you receive in your responses?
Oh gosh, well, one of the questions I'm asked, I suppose, is do I accept that we're in a period of inexorable technological acceleration? And again, I know I'm going against the trend, but I think it's worth stepping back from that too and not thinking about all technologies as the same thing. So I think it depends on what kind of technology we're talking about. I mean, certainly in terms of computing power, in terms of the speed of high-frequency trading, that there's lots of aspects in which we do have phenomenal technological acceleration. But I think there's a lot of other things, like battery life, like genuinely having alternative energy so we didn't have to rely on fossil fuels, that there's lots of ways in which I wish there was more accelerating technology. And I think there's lots of blockages. And I think that's to do with where research investment is going, and also some physical limits to technology. So I think we should pull back from this notion that everything's accelerating and not think that because there's loads of apps being developed every day, that that's a sign of generalized acceleration. And certainly some economic historians would argue, and I'm not sure I agree with this, but I think it's worth stepping back and at least considering whether the sort of industrial revolution we had at the turn of the 19th, 20th century was more radical, actually, than the one we're having now. You know, how would we really compare the transformation then in steam, electricity, locomotives, that sort of technology, and the technological revolution we're having now? I think it's worth stepping back and at least examining this issue of acceleration. So that's one thing people ask me about quite a lot. Another thing people ask me is about whether men and women experience time in exactly the same way. And I think that's a very interesting and difficult question. And I guess what I'd say about that is that I think that while we still have gendered upbringings, masculinity and femininity, and that women are still more responsible for caring, whether it's for children or whether it's for elder care, that makes women think more about the kinds of time that's needed for caring. And it seems to me that the time of caring isn't easily dealt with in terms of digital time, instantaneous time, acceleration. That actually when you're doing caring, it's slow time, it's not digital time, it's a very old-fashioned time. And so I guess those experiences might mean that women's notion of time is somewhat different to men's notion of time. And if anything, I'd like there to be more feminized time than the kind of masculine time of digital labor. And the third thing people ask me about is, well, how then would you go about redesigning technology, making better technologies? And, you know, that's a very difficult question to answer in the abstract. And I guess all I'd say about that is that I just believe that if we had a more diverse set of people having input into technology, into designing technologies, I can't help thinking that we'd have a bigger array of technologies and different priorities set for technologies, and that our imagination on what we might get, like, for example, a self-cleaning home, which is one of the fantasies of feminist utopian science fiction writer had in the 1920s, you know, that we had a home that just cleaned itself, might be higher up on the priority list of the kinds of technologies that we have and are designing.
That's interesting, this idea of having sort of diverse inputs. And I'm just thinking there's just something called the innovator's DNA, where they found that there's these five qualities that help in disruption or innovation anyways. And that's constantly questioning, another part is observing, continually experimenting. But then there's this part called associating with many, many people of different with different ways of thinking and so on, right? And then networking as well. So I guess I got this sort of changed around. Associating was sort of taking diverse points of view and different domains and sort of integrating them. And then networking was associating with different people to get different ideas. And I guess that ties in with what you're saying.
I mean, just a simple example, Stephen, is just think how long it took for older people to insist that mobile phones had larger, buttons on them. I mean, just the sort of, from the most profound things to the simplest things. I just think if young men are doing most of the designing, then it limits the kinds of technologies we might sort of think of.
Yeah, or I guess, again, supported by another study saying that over 50% of success can be tied to links with diverse people clusters. So the more diverse, the better.
Yep.
Now, You've written these amazing books, and you know, the millions of people follow your work, and they just think you're, you know, just outstanding stuff that you've done over your career. What would be the theme of your next book?
Well, actually, I've got a book coming out with a colleague of mine, Nigel Dodd, on the sociology of speed. And what we're trying to do in that book is to talk in a more nuanced way about the different experiences of speed that different groups of people have. So, that, for example, one of the pieces very much stresses waiting, which we've already talked about a bit, that you know, that one of the unintended consequences of technology, and I mean, you know, this is just a trivial example, so forgive me, but, you know, for example, when you, you know, you phone up for a service and you're left hanging on the phone while you're going through various permutations to get through to somebody, or maybe never get through to somebody, there are lots of ways in which the technologies we have actually take up a lot of time as well as saving time. I mean, a more serious example might be if you think about the maintenance and repair of technologies. So actually, the sort of Silicon Valley story is that we get these new shining technologies that work perfectly well. And we all know, actually, that the computers go down a lot, that the software is often lousy, that the websites often don't work, that we lose a lot of stuff, that there are sort of 100 ways in which actually we don't have a seamless experience of information technology. And all of those things are about taking up more and more of our time as consumers. I mean, I think back to things like when in petrol stations, we started filling our own petrol tanks rather than having somebody filling it for us, or that we go to bank machines rather than having tellers. I just think we need to think about time and machines in a more complex way than we have to date, and that quite a lot of things that are going on at the moment are actually causing us as consumers to spend more and more of our time negotiating with websites, negotiating with technology. So the book's trying to think about speed and slowness together, I guess.
That's an interesting thought. It's going to make me now contemplate that while I do things.
You know, and I, you know, and I think the other thing, if I can just add something, is that, you know, we live in a time actually where, I mean, we sociologists talk about it as presentism, but all I mean by that is, you know, we live very much, I think, in the now, in the new, that there's so little sort of discussion really about the history of technologies and about the technologies of everyday life that we still use. You know, nobody wants to have a discussion with me about the electricity grid, about the landline telephone that we're chatting on now, about my heating system, my lighting system, my chairs and tables. All of the everyday technologies that actually, you know, that my cooking, you know, my kitchen, which is full of very old technologies that I rely on every day, that somehow the discussion is just about the new, as if these new technologies aren't completely part of the development of the old, integrated into the old, and are very much sort of built into these new technologies. So I'm sort of very concerned about this notion that we just think about the new and that we forget that actually in 20, 30 years, we'll look back on smartphones and we'll look back on our obsession with email and answering email instantly and our excitement with Facebook and social media. I just think these things are very new and that we may have a very different view of them when we look back in 30 years. They may seem as mundane as my refrigerator and washing machine seem now.
I guess you wouldn't support this, but, you know, some sort of hybrid human in 30 years that doesn't look anything like what you are today because of the integration of us with whatever's upcoming and then reflecting back and saying how mundane social media was back 30 years ago.
Well, I must say, as a reader of history and it may be to do with my age, that I'm more and more struck about the continuities, actually, rather than the sharp breaks in terms of people's capacity and abilities, actually. I mean, you know, when you read about friendship networks, for example, what's very striking is that actually, on the whole, people have got a set of close relationships, many of which are familial. They live in houses and with friends and family in much the way they have historically, that the dating sites actually may be new, but the sort of relationships seem to me very familiar. So I'm afraid I'm with the continuity. I'm with the continuity gang as opposed to the sharp rupture gang.
Yeah, or I guess the recent discoveries that, you know, they analyze the DNA of Europeans and they find what up to 4% is active Neanderthal or Southeast Asians, and they find that maybe, you know, 1, 2, 3, or 4% of that are Denisovans, which are contemporaries of Neanderthal. So maybe those things that we think are old and want to get rid of, but really they're still part of us and they're continuing, and they're the base is still driving, guiding us, and that's the way it is, right? So.
Well, that is what I think, actually. I mean, I am very interested in time use studies where people study in great detail what people do on an average day, you know, how long they spend cooking and washing and all of those things. And while it is true that a huge amount of time is now spent on screen, that is a huge change. I'm not denying that, but the on-screen time is very high. But if you look at all the other patterns of daily life, there is a lot of continuity, and even things like family meals are not as rare as you would think. You know, people still do get up. You know, there are still 24 hours in the day. There's a limit to how many things you can stack into that day, as much as you try.
Now, reflecting back on our conversations, or our conversation here so far, and, you know, the different books that you've put out and all this thinking that you've done in these areas, you know, a big part of my audience are executives, either CEOs,
yep,
or CTOs, and so on. Is there any way they can act on the discussion here or your ideas?
Well, one thing I'd like to focus on as we're talking about time is what's sort of colloquially referred to as the 24/7 culture. I mean, I'm really struck by how there's a cultural value now as being, you know, to being seen as being available all the time, to being available on your smartphone, to be constantly connected, as if to be a senior executive is to be constantly available. I think that that is a specific cultural performance. I think there is no evidence that actually one is more productive if one is constantly connected. Actually, there is a lot of evidence that you need to have time to think and reflect and to write and to do other things. And I think we need executives to really recognize that having, you know, we used to think about it as having a jacket on the back of a chair so it looked like you were always at work. Now it's being always at the end of your smartphone. And I think we need executives to recognize that actually that isn't the smart way to work, it isn't the efficient way to work, and that there needs to be a cultural shift. And I mean, you know, an easy way to do that is to have some policies about email. For example, you know, the story about Daimler and some other German car manufacturers banning emails on weekends and vacations, I think is a great policy, because actually people need time to refresh, you know, and rather than all of us doing meditation and, you know, all of these sort of alternative therapies and Zen and, you know, all these things that are now talked about in terms of corporate practices, you know, I think we need a shift in culture in terms of, you know, recognizing that people will work efficiently for a certain number of hours in the day, and then people need time off to refresh and be creative. So I think execs can do a lot to counter that culture.
Judy, you've done so much and you've made so many different contributions. What things continue to excite you?
Well, you know, it may surprise you given what we've talked about so far, but actually I am terribly excited about the possibilities that digital technologies are bringing forth. I mean, you know, I'm very excited about the fact that lots of people can engage politically in a way they couldn't before. I think it's been particularly important, for example, for women who are stuck at home, for mothers to be able to get online and be part of, you know, online networks and communities. I mean, I think social media has allowed for, you know, a huge blossoming of creativity. I mean, of course, I'm very excited about the possibilities of sort of digitalization. I'm just one of those people that thinks we need also to retain a critical edge, to not be completely sort of utopian about these things, but actually see that, you know, with wonderful websites and political activity, of course, it's given a lot of space to ghastly things on the web. We know racist things, sexual harassment, that there's lots of terrible trolling and things going on as well. So, but, you know, I'm very excited about the newness and the possibilities of technology. I'm very excited about actually the shift in gender relations, that I think masculinity and femininity are being completely reconstructed, and I think relationships between men and women are much more equal than they ever have been before. I think men are changing very quickly, and as I said, fathering is changing. And the notion that perhaps we won't go back to a rigid split between men and women and home and work and, you know, these traditional boundaries, but that we'll have a lot more hybridity and merging of the spaces of work at home and men and women, I think those possibilities are very exciting, and we're just on the cusp of seeing what may occur.
You know, that's quite interesting, your ideas there. Now, what about other areas, particularly related to computing? Do you think, do you have any other areas that you think need to be brought into focus for discussion and policy?
Well, I've said to you I'm very concerned about getting more women into what's called STEM subjects. And I've been involved for 30 years in various projects to get women more involved in computing. And I've been sort of surprised and disappointed that the number of women in engineering and computing over literally three decades in places like America and Britain and Australia is actually worse than it was. It's not better. And so I really, and I think it's not unrelated to my last point, which is this 24/7 culture. I mean, I think as long as there's this idea that to be a genius, to be a young entrepreneur with great ideas, who's going to have the great, you know, new tech startup and going to make a million, is so linked up with having to work all the time, to not having different priorities. I think, you know, we're not going to get anywhere with this issue of women in technology unless we remake our cultural stereotype of what it is to be a brilliant entrepreneur and make it one that's more compatible with living a life that with a bit more relaxation, with a different set of priorities. So, you know, I'm still active around those ideas, and I think we still need to push a bit further on the Women in STEM sort of campaign, really.
Yeah, it just sort of reminds me now, Judy, you know, you just got back from Australia. I assume then you tried it, you know, cut the cord, so to speak, from your phone and email and have weekends where you can contemplate and enjoy life or time to just sort of muse about other things and not work?
Actually, I am not a workaholic. I mean, I do work hard, but I'm not obsessively work-oriented. I think it may be partly people joke about the fact that I'm Australian and hedonistic and used to spend my summers surfing on beaches, and I do like a more relaxed lifestyle. And, you know, I think actually American culture is the pinnacle of the workaholic culture, that if anything is having too much influence on British and Australian culture. And I know if you look at figures that it's much more Americans who have shorter vacations, for example, than Europeans, that don't even take all the holidays they can. I mean, I love the fact that, for example, it's still the case for most of August, when you get in touch with French colleagues, they have an email on saying, you know, we're taking August off. August is holiday time. It's vacation time. And actually, interestingly, some of my British colleagues are trying to do the same thing. I think in some circles, and again, it's privileged circles, here there's a notion that actually in August it's okay to be offline and out of touch. People don't expect you to be working in August. And I mean, when I was doing the Press for Time book, I remember getting something, I can't remember if it was proofs or something, at Christmas time from Chicago Press. And I remember writing back and saying, well, of course, you won't mind if I send this in mid-January because I presume you'll all be off work for several weeks over Christmas. And I got back this note from Chicago saying, actually, we only take off a few days at Christmas. We don't, you know. We're not sort of out of touch for a couple of weeks at Christmas. So I think America, you know, is the sort of iconic place of overwork. And I very much think that that's having a bad influence. The Americanization of other cultures is a bad thing. And we need to have perhaps maybe more a Southern European ethos about work. Perhaps that's what we should adopt. The hot countries ethos about work.
Gee, I can just see the headlines now. Judy says America is bad in terms of... Now, Judy, go ahead, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I literally read a fantastic study some years ago that was literally comparing American executives with French and Norwegian executives. And the guy who did the study found that actually the American executives, I mean, it was a small study, but, you know, that the American executives much more identified their own status and value with the amount of money they earned, with their salary, and were much less concerned than French and Norwegians with having a balanced life and having more leisure time, actually. I mean, I think there is some empirical work that supports my prejudice about this.
Now, Judy, you have many interests. Do you want to talk further about some of them?
I mean, I am interested in the debates about employment and AI and robots, and I'm going to lots of conferences now on this very topic. And I must say that I'm wondering to myself why this topic has become such a major topic. And again, as an economic historian, I look back at previous historical periods, whether it was the Luddites or whether it was Lyndon Johnson, or, you know, the earlier periods where there was such anxiety about machines and technological unemployment. And I do wonder whether what's being reflected is different kinds of anxieties, actually, whether a lot of our anxiety about the insecurity of work, about inequality, about fast changes in terms of globalization, are being sort of funneled on this issue of technology and unemployment, you know, and whether really that is, you know, whether that's really the issue or whether there are more generalized anxieties, even about environmental climate change issues, you know, that there's a lot of, I suppose we're living in an age of thinking that it's an age of heightened risk. I mean, I'm not completely convinced it is, although I completely agree that climate change is a huge risk, and it's not unrelated to the current refugee crisis and a lot of the Middle Eastern politics and, you know, a lot of things that are going on. And I just wonder why a lot of these anxieties are actually being focused on technological unemployment rather these broader questions about politics, globalization, the kinds of governments we've got and how they sort of relate to each other.
Well, again, fascinating. Now, here's a bit of a different kind of question. We're going to go back in time. And can you describe your journey from, let's say, the age of four and major milestones and lessons?
Oh, my goodness, from the age of four. Well, that is going back a very long time. Well, as I say, you know, I'm a Melbourne girl and so very much was brought up in a, you know, hedonistic sort of culture. But I think it's important to say that my parents were Eastern European Jewish refugees and arrived in Australia after the war, and they spent the war in Russia separately, and that my father was in Stalin's Red Army. And I well remember his fascination with cars and industrial machines. He actually repaired tanks during the war for Stalin, believe it or not, you know, in what was then the Soviet Union. And so I guess I got an interest in engineering and technology and machines from a very early age. And I have to confess that I got a sports car at the age of 18, and I absolutely loved it. It was an MGB. And so I loved the sort of possibilities of machines and technology and speed from a very early age. But I then, and this is a sign of the times and my age, I was very involved in anti-war demonstrations in Australia, because Australia was involved in the Vietnam War as an ally of America. And one of the things I picked up during that period was how important science and technology, the links between science and technology and the military, I guess. You know, that science was very implicated in war, in bombs, had been in the Second World War. And I think I've taken that through with me right through my interest in technology. But I think it's always very important to understand the links between Silicon Valley, MIT, and the defense and military establishment. I think that's sort of one of the long lessons I've taken with me through the whole period. Hmm. Should I say more about that?
Yeah, why not? Go for it.
You know, what else can I say? I then went to Britain and studied at Sussex and was very inspired by a guy called Brian Easley, who'd written a book called Fathering the Unthinkable that was actually about the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And in that book, he talks about the scientists at Los Alamos celebrating the bombs and their success as being beautiful science and technology. And then, as you'll know, in all the decades later, reflecting back on the responsibility they had as scientists for creating such destruction. And so that's been part of a lifelong interest in the social responsibility of scientists and engineers. And this conference I was at in Melbourne a couple of weeks ago was actually a conference in memory of Norbert Wiener. And so actually, I, you know, it was fascinating to me. It was run by the Melbourne University Engineering Department, and they were exactly talking about how Wiener had very close Japanese contacts, actually, before the Second World War. He was close to some Japanese scientists. And they had some correspondence that they discovered that they were discussing at this conference in Melbourne, and how he had been totally disturbed by the droppings of the bomb in Japan, and he was a professor at MIT, as you know, and that after the war he refused to take any more defense contracts in his work in cybernetics. And so this conference in Melbourne was wonderful because it's actually about the fact that I think engineering now is much more attuned to the social responsibility of engineering and science and what they're doing, and the need to engage with broader publics about the direction of science and technology in the future.
You know, it kind of reminds me, I was asked to keynote the International Conference on Software Engineering, and they wanted me to talk on software engineering. I didn't. I talked about innovation and social change and the ramifications of that and the implications to them as researchers and the impact they're having on the world. And I know the hosts were predicting, you can't talk about those topics, you know, it's not going to work. And they were really worried, but it actually worked. And in fact, I scared the audience. I was surprised that the researchers said, you frightened us. You know, in terms of the implications of what we're doing, right? And getting yep. to reflect. So I guess that speaks to what you're saying as well.
Yes, and, you know, and I think actually, you know, the current discussion, we really haven't got onto this, but I mean, the fact that there's talk in Silicon Valley about a guaranteed minimum income is recognition of the fact that if you're designing technologies that put people out of work, then perhaps you've got some responsibility to making sure that people will have enough money to live on and to be able, and that they'll have enough money to buy your goods. I mean, perhaps it's worth saying in this interview with you that I'm not a supporter of this guaranteed minimum income, because I don't like this future that's being posited by some of these Silicon Valley people, which is that there'll be a section of the population working 24/7, doing enriching, engaging, creative, interesting work, and that lots of other people will be given an income to just consume, if you like. You know, I mean, I, as a sociologist of work, have always been very clear about the fact that work is important to people, that it gives people an identity, it gives people a routine. I mean, you know, we know that the unemployed spend a lot of time watching TV, that it's actually very hard to live without some routine institutions, without the sociability of workplaces. That I think work is very important to people's self-identity and to satisfaction, and that I think we should much more be thinking about redistributing work, having shorter working hours for lots of people, thinking about how we can produce creative, interesting work in decent conditions for many more people, and not thinking about this division between, you know, the people who are overworked on the one hand and underworked or have insufficient work on the other.
Again, fascinating. Now, here's a broader question, and we're coming down to our last few questions here.
Yep.
You choose a topic area. What do you see as some of the top broader challenges facing us today, and do you have any proposals of how they can be solved?
Well, I think the one I've said is one of the biggest challenges, actually. I'm really struck by how much discussion there is now about the number of people who are unemployed, the number of people who are underemployed, who are doing part-time work, who are working on zero-hours contracts, casual employment. I'm very struck by, you know, I was recently, for example, at a terrific conference in Berlin with lots of young people working in new media in creative industries, doing fantastic things, actually, politically engaged, you know, great young people, but talking about the fact that they just can't imagine how they'll ever have enough money to buy a house, and that if they can't actually have some stability in where they live, how are they going to think about having children? How are they going to have the stability to go to local schools? How are they going to sort of plan a life that we've had, which is one based on a long-term plan? I mean, if you even think about things like mortgages to buy a house, they're all based on the assumption that there's some long-term job plan that you have where you can really think about paying off a house over 25 years, being in the same location, having a sort of community of people to share with. And you know, what we've got at the moment is that a lot of these, if you like, roots of stability, of a stable life, are being knocked off, both by disruptive technologies, but also, it seems to me, by, you know, neoliberal market policies and globalization. And so I think the real challenges are how to re-instantiate some kind of stable route to a stable life that aren't, they won't be the same as what we had before. We're not going to have a career for life, you know, which we talked about sort of 30 years ago. And we're not anymore going to have a family based on a breadwinner model where men go to work and women stay at home. So we need new models, I think, but models that will allow people to sort of plan some time ahead, because I think without those plans, people feel very much adrift in terms of how they sort of project their lives, how they think about a narrative of their lives, if you like.
Again, just some intriguing ideas and thoughts that you're sharing. Now, here's a question. You know, you're this world-renowned scientist and researcher. You've contributed so much to the world, to the dialogue. But from all of this work that you do, from speaking and traveling, are there any sort of interesting stories that you can share? Maybe something that, you know, really surprised you, or you thought, wow, that's quite funny, or something unexpected?
Well, I was terribly amused recently when I was at a conference in Washington with various sort of CEOs of large companies, and I think I was talking about technology and time at some point or other. And I mean, literally over lunch, all of these CEOs got out their smartphones and showed me their electronic diaries, or I think you call them calendars, and were literally saying to me, you know, Jude, you really have to understand that the main problem in Silicon Valley is time and a shortage of time, and we're spending a huge amount of money designing the most fantastic electronic calendars, and this will be the solution to our problems. And I really just had to smile and think to myself, well, here is a classic of thinking that actually there's a technological solution to every problem. And what I've sort of spent my life trying to argue is that actually there isn't a technological fix or solution for every problem, that the problems of time are about how we organize our life, what our priorities are, what our relationships are, and that no smartphone is going to solve that problem. So that made me smile, actually. It really made me smile. That was one thing. I mean, perhaps another story that you won't like as much that kind of shocked me rather than making me smile is that I was in Barcelona recently, and Barcelona every year hosts the International Mobile Phone Conference. Perhaps you've heard of it, Stephen. You know, we're experts on the mobile phone. You know, it's called the World Congress, I think, of mobile phones or something. Anyway, it happens in Barcelona every year, and I was being interviewed and speaking to some people there in one of the cultural centres, and I said, oh gosh, I've popped into a few venues, and, you know, there are sort of tens of thousands of people fly into Barcelona for the weekend. And they said to me, have you noticed, they said, that we specially, not we, sorry, take away the we, but that prostitutes are specially flown into Barcelona for that weekend, because actually the Mobile Phone Congress is predominantly full of men, and the prostitution in Barcelona that weekend is phenomenal, and that prostitutes literally come to the city for that weekend to service people who come to the Mobile Phone Congress. Now, I'm not making any normative judgment about prostitutes. I'm just making the point about the maleness of these technology cultures and how unchanged they are. And I hope I live long enough to go to something like a World Congress on mobile phones, on artificial intelligence, on video games, and actually see a representative sample of men and women. That would be nice. That would be a different thing. There would be different, you know, it would have a different look and feel about it.
That's an interesting idea, and it kind of reminds me of, there's this TED conference called TEDxLA, TEDx Los Angeles.
Yep.
And the theme is imagine, and the imagine theme is imagine there's a world where there's complete diversity, or imagine a poverty
is
solved. Yeah, and in fact, countries are going to be involved, and cities and things like that. And a lot of these speakers have been pulled in because of projects that they've taken on this theme, imagine. It reminds me of what you just said. You know, imagine this mobile conference where there's complete diversity, right? And
yeah. I mean, can I just give you another imagine, for example? I mean, I go to lots of talks now on caring robots and the problem of, you know, the problem, which is always called a problem, of the aging population in Japan, in Europe. How are we going to deal with all these old people? We need to have, you know, robotic carers to deal with them because it's a problem. And rarely in any of these discussions is there the imagination to think of different housing solutions. I mean, what if we imagined living in a set of apartments where there were young people and there were old people, that we didn't have old people segregated in old people's homes, but we had old people integrated into communities where there were young people and able-bodied people, and that we had some sort of rota of people looking after people, you know, not just on the whole, you know, women looking after their elderly parents, but we shared out the care of old people by redesigning housing and redesigning the city so that we didn't think of the problem of old people in the same kind of way. I mean, they're the radical solutions we need to some of the problems, not robotics.
You know, that's a really interesting thought. I'm going to share that with the producer of TEDxLA. That's a great You may get an invitation to speak.
Well, wouldn't that be a very different way of thinking about it, though, really?
Yeah, it definitely would. Now, we're down to our last question, and I'm turning the tables. If you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Oh, gosh, that's very difficult. I mean, I would ask me about how to re-envisage different kinds of scenarios for technologies, and I think I've given you one. I think the sort of caring robot is a sort of classic one, actually, the caring for old people. I would re-envisage the city and housing. So if I may, that would be sort of one thing, and I hope I've given an answer to that. I would also ask me about the effects of robotics on employment, and I think I've given you an answer to that in terms of the redistribution of work and shorter working hours and redesigning work so that, you know, I mean, I don't want to go back to the romanticization of kind of craft work, but I mean, it is the case that there are lots of skills and creativity that people have and enjoy. People enjoy making things, get a lot of satisfaction of making things. And, you know, I'm not saying we should all go back to baking our own bread and making our own jewelry and doing a lot of craft work. But I do think that some of the ideas about, you know, maker culture are very important to reconstitute and reconnect with. And perhaps we are coming to an era where, you know, there's always been a tension between standardized cheap products and products that are sort of handmade or niche made. And, you know, rather than having 3D printers, which I know is all the go now, making individual products, perhaps we ought to revalue the sort of skills that people have for making things and be willing to sort of pay for a lot of craft production and think about production and machines as enhancing skills and not about de-skilling people. And, you know, the third question would be that everybody does ask me, which is about, do I still think technology is gendered? That I wrote about this in the 1980s and 90s, and do I still think there's a problem about gender and technology? And unfortunately, I do think there's still a problem. We've talked about that. And I really would like women to be much more integrated into the spheres of technological production and design, which we've talked about. Having more diverse workforces, I think, would make an enormous difference, actually, in terms of our priorities and the kinds of things we might think about.
Well, Judy, you shared so many of your deep insights, and I know your schedule is demanding, and we are indeed fortunate you've come in to do this interview. So thank you for sharing so much with our audience.
Well, thank you. I very much enjoyed it. Thank you for such great questions.
Judy, it was a lot of fun. And I want to close by saying that Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Judy Wiseman, globally renowned professor, London School of Economics, and bestselling author.